Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will ask the marshal to call us in.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfield, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Diane Bratfield presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Welcome again to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is November 17th, 2021. I will make just a few remarks before the start of the argument, but I want to make sure our audio record is clear. You, of course, appreciate, and we can see you, that these proceedings are proceeding according to Zoom on a Zoom format. And we are doing this by video conference. We very much appreciate the use of this technology during the current pandemic. And nonetheless, this panel is going to has four matters on its calendar today. Three of those are oral. We have the lawyers in front of us for the first matter. And I know that your sound and video have been checked. We just did it again quickly. You know what to do if for some reason you lose us. I know you've got instructions in that regard, or if you're just having difficulties. And please let us know. We'll make sure that we accommodate that and correct it in some way. So before we go ahead with the first arguments, like I said, I have a couple of minor comments, but I'll ask the marshal to call that case.
Now calling case A210441 in the matter of the licensing order issued to Gaffney Construction and Stephen Gaffney individually.
Reading counsel, you are familiar, I'm sure, with our procedures, which, with the exception of the fact that we're proceeding by Zoom, are exactly the same. And so, as I said, there is an audio recording that's being maintained along with what our video today. But we will post the audio recording on the court's website. And so that we keep that recording and record clear, we ask you to identify yourself and the client that you represent before the start of your arguments. And then we also ask you to please keep a close eye on the clock. It should be visible on the screen in front of you, and you're both nodding. That's good. So that it tends to go quickly. We very much enjoy the conversations with you today. We've read the briefs and we're prepared to discuss your case, but we want to make sure that you are aware of the time restrictions that are in play. So keep your eye on the clock. So with that, I'm ready to hear from counsel for appellant. You can begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Daniel Gallatin. I am counsel for Mr. Stephen Gaffney and Gaffney Construction. And although I can't certainly confirm it based upon my viewing of the participants, Mr. Gaffney is, I believe, at least appearing via a listening mode, if not actually on the screen. And so based on my experience, the court is extremely well-versed in the pleadings that have been submitted. And as such, I'll refrain from reciting or regurgitating essentially what's therein. But here's what I do think is very, very important for sort of a flavor and understanding of how we are situated. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, of course, regulates residential building contractors. In 2017, Mr. Stephen Gaffney was a licensed real estate agent who had attempted to help Ms. Sawyer find a home suitable for her stated purposes. That effort was unsuccessful. There is no indication that in any way Mr. Gaffney failed in trying to help her or was dishonest in his capacities as a real estate agent with her or anything else. They just couldn't find a property. Collaboratively, then, they come to what they think is a solution. If we can't buy an existing home, Ms. Sawyer is to build. That, to me, dovetails directly into what I think is sort of the top of the iceberg as far as the issues go. In June and July of 2017, or in any event prior to October 2017, did Mr. Gaffney act or hold himself out as a residential building contractor when he didn't have a license? As we start into these issues, with the critical omission that I think perpetuates the state's findings is the lack of attention to what the statutes actually say and what the evidence actually was. For someone to be a residential building contractor and be subject to licensure, they have to engage in two or more special skills. That's under 326B point 082, I believe.
I have a kind of a threshold question. I just want to make sure that my understanding of the law here is clear. So you move to whether there's a violation. And if I understand it correctly, a license revocation is supported, would be affirmed on appeal. Presumably the commissioner would first determine this, which is what happened here, based on one or more violations. We have several in the record in front of us. The commissioner has found several violations. And that means, I think, that this court need only affirm on one of those violations in order to affirm the commissioner's determination as to a violation. Do I have that right or am I wrong?
To an extent, that's correct in that the commissioner has the authority to determine penalties. But
yeah, I was meaning to separate out the penalty question. So just looking at the violation portion of the, because you did separate it that way in your brief too. You have right. one issue focused on violations, one on penalty.
Yes, because, and the reason is because historically, the penalties imposed by the commissioner has a commensurate level of harshness to the degree or the number of violations. So if somebody, for example, historically within the Labor and Industry Department, fails to renew a license by a couple of days, they don't suffer revocation. The collective actions are what relate to the penalty imposed. Similar in the effect of, as you see in the reasoning, which I've addressed to some extent, but the flawed reasoning and the monetary penalty imposed. It is an example of how they assess the penalty to impose based upon violations. Therefore,
and I appreciate that that's your second issue. What I was just trying to make sure I understood correctly was the relationship. So, of course, if you win on your first issue, we're done, right? There has to be a violation in order to impose a penalty. So I don't mean to waylay your argument. It sounded to me like you were going to the first violation, which was the commissioner's determination that Mr. Gaffney held himself out as a residential building contractor before he had a license. So please, go ahead to that, since it looks like, if we were going to affirm, and I just say if, I'm just trying to understand the legal framework, if we were to affirm that a finding of a violation, that would be, put us one step through this appeal, because we wouldn't even necessarily need to look at the other violations that were found by the commissioner.
I do think, though, the appropriate step would be if there is, for example, a finding that not all of the commissioner's findings of sanctions or findings of violations are affirmed, then there is a reason for the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry to revisit the penalties imposed. Because once it's remanded, for example, or should it be the case that it's remanded and said, well, look, there is not actually a viable conclusion by the Department of Labor and Industry that there was a violation of the statutory code, licensing code that prohibits conviction or failure to effectuate or comply with a building code notice.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I understand your position, but like I said, I don't want to waylay from the first violation. So let's go there. Counsel, what do you think your strongest argument is for this court reversing the commissioner's determination that there was that first violation? Mr. Gaffney held himself as a residential building contractor, held himself out before he was licensed.
The strongest points are when you look at the statutory requirement for one to act or hold themselves out as a residential building contractor, they have to offer or actually do two special skills. Those special skills are enumerated statutorily and in our memorandum. What has been identified as the evidence, which apparently affirms the conclusion as to acting or holding out, is that there are checks to Gaffney Construction, and that he stated, Mr. Gaffney stated that he could in the future build a home for Ms. Sawyer if he were able to, or when he gets his license. That is cited in the memorandum and in the transcript. He expressly affirmed.
These are the checks that totaled $16,300, right?
Correct. There are three of them.
And we do have testimony from the complainant in this case, JS, as to what those checks were for.
Right.
Right. And what is her testimony, counsel?
Right. Buying materials, which is not a special skill.
Roofing materials, to be specific. Roofing materials, drafting, yeah. And excavation, right?
Yes. And payment to go and procure excavation plans from Blue Line Drafting. But those are not special skills.
Excavation is a special skill listed. Roofing is a special skill, isn't it?
No, it's the acquisition of materials. It was not a
roofing. I understand. But okay. It's evidence, right?
It is not evidence. There is no evidence that Ms. Sawyer believed Mr. Gaffney was going to provide roofing services.
So she thought he was going to build the house without providing roofing services?
No. What we're talking about is the point of the payments made in June and July. The point of the payments made in June, July were not under the pretense of Mr. Gaffney is going to provide, at that point, the roofing services. What's in evidence from both parties on the testimony is that Mr. Gaffney, number one, was going to use the funds, because there is one check payable to him individually, for living, for purposes of getting the license.
So that I find that testimony incredibly confusing. I don't know that it matters here because the district court didn't find Mr. Gaffney credible on this point. But explain that to me. I mean that Mr. Gaffney would get living expenses from the person for whom he is building a home. That's not in the contract. I read your contract.
No, I totally agree with you, Your Honor. It's not in the contract. But what was happening at the time, and important contextually, is that for it to proceed where Mr. Gaffney gets the license, if he's going to take the time to work with Ms. Sawyer to get a home built, it means then he is going to not engage in other activities that could give him income.
So you're saying they had some kind of side agreement? That what she's going to support him while he gets situated to get his license? I mean, like I said, the district court didn't find it credible. The ALJ adopted by the commissioner didn't find it credible. And of course, we're going to defer to those credibility determinations. So I don't know that we want to go along this line of living expenses. Why don't you get back to whether the special skills were involved?
Sure. Thank you. So what we don't have is evidence that he actually, Mr. Gaffney, that is, actually offered to engage in a pre-licensure term. He didn't offer to engage in these special skills. What was offered to him, what was actually done pre-licensure, was secure the drafting plans, not a special skill, and obtain materials, which is not a special skill. And in fact, of course, in this June and July timeframe, he could not have actually offered or worked to put on a roof. Ms. Sawyer didn't have any land to build on. She didn't actually acquire land and didn't actually have any ability to commence construction on anything until well after the timeframe. And both she knew that, as did Mr. Gaffney himself. So the evidence on that element, I think, and I argue here, is not capturing what the statute actually requires for someone to be actually engaging in activity requiring licensure, nor do the actual statements or evidence in the record suggest or affirm that he actually represented at that time before licensure, he could build her house or offer to build her house. Instead, the evidence is actually, at best, Ms. Sawyer assumed it, and at best for us, on the other side, and in a different way of using best, Mr. Gaffney actually affirmed expressly, and the ALJ acknowledged he would need to get the license, and he told her that, and that was going to happen in the future for him to proceed.
When you say that Ms. Sawyer assumed something, you're saying she assumed what? That Mr. Gaffney was going to get his license? Or
she only assumed in June and July of 17 that he had a license. So it was not.
Well, but you also argue that she was aware that he didn't have his license. So
correct. I'm saying is the best evidence in the record that she believed he had a license, mm-hmm. which is not very good evidence at all. The best evidence in the record that she believed she had a license is her testimony that she assumed he did. She didn't actually believe he did. She didn't actually state as evidence that he represented he did. She only assumed that Mr. Gaffney did. That's it. And
her assumption. To prove a violation, they don't have to prove this. As I understand a violation of the statute, it does not focus on Ms. Sawyer's belief. So again, maybe we're going down a path that isn't very helpful to you here. It's what Mr. Gaffney did, whether he held himself out as a residential building contractor before he had obtained his license, not really what Ms. Sawyer believed or didn't believe.
I understand and I agree with that. But also what's important is that the evidence collectively is looked at in the context of determining whether a violation occurred. And I think that adds context.
And of course, we don't reweigh the evidence under the substantial evidence test. So I see the clock is ticking. Did you want to move on to the penalty portion? Because of course, that, like you indicated at the beginning, that is the second crucial half of your argument.
Well, I think the penalty portion certainly did dovetail as to the absence of substantiation for this. I think the penalty is not, I think, the most aggressive of the arguments to be had as to the order, because there is some element of discretion to the department for that. But if we look at additionally, for example, the conclusion that there is a breach of contract, what we have no evidence of, no conclusion, no statement of through the administrative law judge or in the final licensing order is, which is required as law, damages. Statutorily, even under the Department of Labor and Industry standard, and within the statement of law enunciated time and again by the Supreme Court, for there to be a breach of contract, there have to be damages. And statutorily,
you have the statutory language handy. It's injury to the public, isn't it?
Yes, that was my communication on the other end of it, and I do have it. It is 326.
Right, but isn't it injury to the public as opposed to damages to the individual?
Right, and that's what I'm communicating. Okay. Statutorily, right. Injury or harm to the public is the department's requirement. And then under Minnesota Supreme Court and our standard breach of contract law, damages. So even within the licensing penalty order, I believe it's at paragraph 4 on page 3, it only states conclusory that there is a damage, that there is a harm. There is nothing recited as to what actually constitutes the damage or harm or injury to the public. And with that, the fastest 15 minutes we ever experienced at the Court of Appeals, it has now transpired.
It does go quickly, counsel. We do really appreciate your response to the questions. And you will have 5 minutes, if you choose, for your rebuttal. So.
Thank you.
I think the clock has been reset and we are ready to hear from the respondent. So, counsel, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Alan Barr. I represent the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. The court should affirm the commissioner's order revoking Gaffney's residential building contractor license and imposing a $16,300 penalty because the commissioner's findings and conclusions are supported by substantial evidence, and the license revocation and a civil penalty reflect a sound exercise of the commissioner's discretion. Because Mr. Gallatin focused primarily on the first violation, whether or not Mr. Gaffney held himself out or acted as a residential building contractor, I'd like to begin with that. As the court correctly noted, the statute is violated if someone acts or holds out as a residential building contractor without a license. The evidence in the record is that in May of 2018, before Mr. Gaffney was licensed, he told Ms. Sawyer, "I can build you a house." She then sold her existing house and moved into a trailer based on the understanding that Mr. Gaffney would be able to build her a house. Obviously, building a house requires more than two skills. You're going to be excavating, putting in a foundation, putting up walls, putting up roofing, finishing. To the extent that Mr. Gaffney is arguing that there weren't any special skills offered at that time, building a house clearly meets that requirement. Moreover, even if there was ambiguity about whether there was an offer or whether that offer was contingent on Mr. Gaffney getting a license, which he didn't do until September or October. In July of...
I think the department's records say September, counsel.
Okay, yes. Yeah, September. Mr. Gaffney received payments for building a house in July of 2017. He received a check for excavation services. He received a check for drafting plans. He received a check for building materials. People don't receive payments for those things unless they are going to then proceed to engage in those skills, proceed in excavation, proceed in building a roof with roofing materials that had been purchased. Although there was no formal contractual agreement between them until October, there was clearly an agreement by July, and Mr. Gaffney was acting as a resident building contractor in July when he accepted the money and started taking steps to get the house built before he had a license.
So I think, counsel, if you would just humor me and respond directly to the argument that appellant's counsel is making, which is really what these verbal discussions were between Ms. Sawyer and Mr. Gallatin, or I'm sorry, Mr. Gaffney, were preparations for him to be a residential building contractor, that he was in the process, had been one in the past, was going to get relicensed, he knew how to do it, and so was making preparations for that. Is that the same under the law as holding oneself out as a residential? I mean, everyone's going to have a path toward whatever they do. You did it in the law. You obviously are careful not to practice law before you have a license. But in this case, Mr. Gaffney was on his path toward getting his license again. And they had these conversations. He did get some funds to buy just the supplies. He didn't take steps to excavate. He didn't build a roof. He didn't, I forget if there were other special skills, but for sure those two things. So could you respond to that argument?
Certainly. So just because someone doesn't go out and build the roof or start excavation doesn't mean they are in compliance with the statute. The statute prohibits, first of all, it prohibits holding out. So even offering to do it when you don't have a license is a violation. Just as if, you know, when I wasn't licensed, I couldn't go out and say, I am a lawyer, you could hire me to represent you. Mr. Gaffney could not say, I'm a residential building contractor, or I guess I'm not a residential building contractor, but nevertheless, you can hire me and give me money, and I will start taking steps to build you a house. Because that's what happened here. In July, he was taking steps.
Counsel, can you point me to the specific provision of the statute that you're invoking here?
Yes, Your Honor. So, MnSTAT 326B.805, subdivision 3, says that no person may act or hold themselves out as a residential building contractor without a residential building contractor license. And then if you turn to the definition of residential building contractor in 326B.802, that is a person that is in the business of building real estate or of contracting or offering to contract with an owner to build residential real estate by providing two or more special skills.
All right, thank you.
And Mr. Barr, just to be clear, what specific actions do you think support the decision that he was holding himself out as a contractor? I think that's what you're relying on, correct?
Sure. Yes. I think there's two. It's okay. The department's position that he held himself out in May when he said, I can build you a house. And then it's the department's position that he acted as a building contractor when he took money and started contracting with others, with subcontractors, excavators, suppliers and subcontractors, but contracting with suppliers to buy supplies, that he was acting as a building contractor. Even if the court doesn't believe that is acting, that still at least would be holding out, but it's the department's position that is actually acting as a building contractor when he starts contracting with others to get this house built.
But why would a statement that I can build you a house, why would that be holding yourself out as a contractor if the person also says, but I need to get my license first?
Because you're offering a service you can't perform it, and obviously that puts some color on it. Yes, that if you disclose you aren't licensed at the time you need to get it, then the injured party is at least aware. But the statute doesn't say if you disclose you can't do the job. If you disclose you aren't authorized to build buildings, you can nevertheless offer it contingent on getting licensed. The statute says you cannot offer to contract if you are not licensed.
So going back to the analogy that Judge Bradfold had, what if as a law student, well, let's say you actually graduate from law school and you're mm-hmm. the bar exam and you're just waiting to get the results to determine whether or not you're actually licensed. And you have clients coming in, or you have people coming to you and saying, hey, I'd love to hire you. And you say, I would love to do work for you, but I have to wait until I find out whether or not I'm licensed. Is that holding yourself out if you have that disclaimer, you have that caveat?
I think there's a slight nuance there that's different. So there you're saying, I would love to work for you, but I can't yet. Here, on the other hand, in May, Mr. Gaffney tells Ms. Sawyer, I will build a house for you. I just need to get licensed. And moreover, she takes actions based on that. She sells her existing house. She moves into an RV on Mr. Gaffney's lot while her house is, in theory, going to be built. She believes, initially, she testified, that the house would be done by October. So it's more than just I could do this in the abstract. It's there's an agreement that it's going to happen once he gets licensed. Whereas in your example, it's just, I would like to be able to work for you, but I'm not licensed. I can't. There's no firm commitment to any lawyer work as opposed to this firm commitment to build the house.
So, counsel, you heard my question to appellant's counsel about what this court needs to decide in order to determine whether to affirm the commissioner's decision or reverse it. And it seemed to me that it is that we would have to examine and decide the commissioner's decision could be affirmed as to at least one violation. And we've already spent a lot of time talking about one violation. So first of all, do I have that basic construct right? If I don't,
somewhat,
let me know.
Your Honor, so the commissioner is limited to a $10,000 penalty per violation. Okay. The penalty in this case was $16,300. One violation would not support a $16,300 penalty. Right, you would need to affirm at least two.
From your standpoint, we should definitely give you the opportunity to talk about more than one violation. So what, with looking at the clock, what do you think your second strongest violation is?
I believe, Your Honor, the second strongest violation is the failure to, just in terms of is a violation sworn, I think it's the failure to give complete or accurate information to the department. There was uncontroverted testimony that the department's investigator asked for Mr. Gaffney's insurance coverage, specifically asked for Bill's risk insurance. The investigator testified he never got any insurance, and we further learned during the trial, Builder's risk insurance never existed, even after Mr. Gaffney said he would supply that insurance to the department. So I think just factually, that's the clearest one. I think, however, the most egregious other violation is the breach of contract. Ms. Sawyer was promised that she could move into her house on January 31, 2018. She was not able to move in until after Memorial Day of 2018, about 5 months later.
So here's where I find the breach of contract violations to be at least complicated for this court to review. I noticed that in your brief, in response to the arguments made by appellant that a breach requires not just a finding of breach, but also a finding of damages, and in this case, it's damages to Ms. Sawyer, that the in this case, the underlying decision that was adopted by the commissioner, the ALJ's findings, don't include findings of damages on each of the breach of contract claims. And so you tried to supply that from the record. You looked at the record, you made arguments saying, well, but we could find damages. You know, of course, this court doesn't make findings of fact, certainly doesn't find damages. So no. I'm just wondering whether you really want the court to go there.
Your Honor, frankly, the commission believes all of them are supported, but as specifically as to that breach of contract issue, the ALJ made findings. Actually, this court doesn't make findings. However, this court reviews legal questions de novo, and it's a legal question of whether Ms. Sawyer was damaged by this contract or by the breach of contract. That legal conclusion is implicit in the ALJ's finding that the statute was violated. Specifically, Ms. Sawyer was damaged.
I'm not talking about the statutory violations. I'm talking about the breach of contract.
Okay.
I understood that to be the challenge the appellant was putting out.
So the ALJ's conclusion that there was a breach of contract in violation of the statute is a legal conclusion there was a breach of contract. Implicit in that is a legal conclusion that breach of contract elements are met. And the ALJ found Ms. Sawyer was delayed in moving in for 5 months. Now, Mr. Gaffney's argument is that, well, she had somewhere else. She was allowed to stay in Mr. Gaffney's home during those 5 months and also during other winter months. Common law recognizes that real property is unique. The mere fact that you have somewhere else to live doesn't excuse the fact that she didn't get to move into the home she bargained for, her dream home, as she put it, until later. And that even then, construction wasn't done until November 2019, over a year, almost 2 years after it was originally supposed to be complete. I do briefly want to address the penalties that were imposed. Commissioner exercised sound discretion in revoking Mr. Gaffney's license. The ALJ's memorandum adopted by the commissioner amply shows that he, as the ALJ put it, he is a foolhardy builder and shouldn't be in the business of building contracting. Additionally, the civil penalty is also well supported by the record and not an abuse of discretion. The ALJ and the commissioner found 4 violations, creating a penalty cap of potentially $40,000. Within that range, $16,000 is eminently reasonable both to deter future misconduct and to adequately measure the benefit that Mr. Gaffney received in light of the violations. As a result, the commissioner asked this court to affirm her order revoking Mr. Gaffney's license and imposing the $16,300 civil penalty.
Counsel, I guess in thinking about it, I want to make sure I ask you one additional question, which I touched on briefly with appellant's counsel. So I'm going to extend your time as presiding judge so that you get a chance to answer it. So I noticed that the statute does refer to injury to the public, but there's also these findings needed necessary, the analysis by the underlying opinion decision included damages to Ms. Sawyer based on the breaches of contract. And you touched on one of them, the delay. So where does the injury to the public come in? Is that only in the penalty portion?
So injury to the public is within that any member of the public. So was the public injured by this? And yes, Ms. Sawyer was.
And so that relates to the violation, whether there's a violation.
Yeah.
It
also relates to this. It's one of the factors in MnSTAT 14045 subdivision 3 that the commissioner has to consider is injury to the public in determining the amount of civil penalty.
Thank you. Do any of the other panel members have questions? Thank you very much, counsel. So we're going to reset the clock for rebuttal. There it is. So counsel for appellant, we're ready for you when you are. You are muted, I'm afraid.
Okay, I apologize. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'm just going to jet directly to some of these certain points. With respect to the statement that Mr. Gaffney failed or refused, according to their best evidence and best position, to provide his insurance coverages, I would direct the court's attention to Trial Exhibit 34. Within that, the statement recited by Mr. Gartland, the department's senior investigator, includes that during our phone conversation, comma, following your email message below, you promised to provide a copy of your insurance coverages and your final accounting for this project. The insurance coverages provided, according to the record, actually are the insurance coverages that existed. We acknowledge, Mr. Gaffney acknowledged, he didn't provide workers' compensation proof of coverage because he didn't have it. He didn't provide proof of builder's risk insurance because it doesn't exist and he didn't have it. There's no evidence in this record, if this is their best violation of false, deception, or misleading, that something existed that Mr. Gaffney didn't produce. And we clarified and had to clarify it through trial. Well, you didn't provide us the plans and specifications. Yeah, we didn't, because at the time the department requested that information, it was not in Mr. Gaffney's possession. That was with Ms. Sawyer when she moved out of his house. And the department agreed, Mr. Gartland agreed in the trial. If something didn't exist, it is not a violation to not produce it. And that is exactly what happened with respect to the insurance coverages. And that's what's in the evidence in the record. With respect to this connotation of harm or damage to the public, Your Honor, I think Judge Bradfield, you're exactly correct in that we're not here to now create some finding. When you look at the recommendations of Administrative Judge Littman and the licensing order with penalty, the word damages is all that appears in Judge Littman's recommendations. He doesn't even speak to any single recommendation that there is damage or harm to the public. And within the licensing order and penalty, it is only a conclusion. The
I'm not sure I agree with you if you consider the memorandum that was written by Judge Littman, where he explains in his decision to favorable to your client reduce the penalty, that his focus was on, you know, having Mr. Gaffney disgorge the improperly obtained $16,000 that he got before when he held himself out as having a contractor's license, but before he had it. So I think that that there was a focus not just on how Ms. Sawyer had been harmed in paying that $16,000, but how the public is generally harmed by individuals holding themselves out prior to their license. So, you know, I think if you're going to address this issue, counsel, you better go with the whole thing.
Well, certainly. And I think, Your Honor, then what's being missed here is the conclusion that's stated, and what the alleged harm is, that the $16,300 paid was exclusively for Mr. Gaffney, and it wasn't, because what the state is identifying these dollars both zigged and zagged. Number one, they say, well, you got paid to do special skills. If that's the case, then at least some of the $16,300 went to support their conclusion that there was a violation, which also then means that Ms. Sawyer received the benefit of at least a portion of the monies paid. You can't have $1 serving two purposes, but that's what they're arguing.
Can you point to me in the record where there's an accounting of what happened with the $16,000? Because I looked for that and I couldn't find it, but I might have missed it.
So with 45 seconds left, there is a trial exhibit that has a final accounting from Mr. Gaffney as to the monies, and arrives at an amount that he is still owed and has a reference there.
I'm sure you referred to that in your brief. So probably if I look for it there, I'll find it, right?
Here it would be the point. It is now a new creation that is not in the record, that is not in the recommendation, and that is not in the licensing order, that the amount that the monies paid by Ms. Sawyer that she actually received the benefit of could legally or serve as a harm, or that it actually served as a harm. And so with that, we have no time. I appreciate Your Honor's inquiry and the ability to respond.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks both counsel. This is very helpful for the court to have you address our questions. We really appreciate it.